Tim Galway is my guest in this call, and I am thrilled to introduce you to him. Tim Galway is a friend of mine, but more than that, he is a mentor and the pioneer of a method known as the inner game. Tim was a nationally ranked tennis player in his division and captained the Harvard University tennis team, and eventually went on to write a book called The Inner Game of Tennis, which has sold over 2 million copies. It is still the best-selling sports psychology book in the world. And he went on to write other inner game books that applied the same exact principles to golf, skiing, music, work, and stress. And in the years since the first release of that book, which was 40 years ago, readers began to apply that to all kinds of areas of life on and off the court. And he has done a number of engagements with corporations. His long-term clients include Apple, AT&T, Coca-Cola, Rolls-Royce, and any number of things. He also runs retreats and workshops, which I have had the privilege of attending and learning firsthand the incredible power of his inner game methods. Tim, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's my pleasure.
Great. Well, to get started, why don't we familiarize our listeners with what the inner game approach is and how it got started for you?
Well, I'll try to keep it short, and you can ask questions that might point to the holes I've left. But
let me ask this to start. You, in the inner game, you make a distinction between self-one and self-two. What is the difference?
Well, self-two is the sum total of all your human potential, that which you've actualized and that which you've not yet actualized. So it's where the leader is, it's where the visionary is, it's where the worker is. It's for everything that requires your potential. Self one is kind of the frontal cortex, which has a function of thinking the consequences of certain actions, thinking for a team, strategic thinking. But it's also that voice in your head that's pretending to be your leader and telling you how you should and shouldn't lead. And so it's often the source of doubt. Oh, I'm not so good at that. I'm not so good at that. I have to try hard. And in the trying hard, you actually get in your own way. So leaders need to know that there's a source of interference and there's a source of potential. And obviously the goal of the inner game is maximize the expression of your potential and minimize the interference.
That's great.
And
now
simple summary.
Sorry about that. Yeah, didn't mean to interrupt. So when I got a chance to go study with you, you had us, we were there for the inner game of coaching, actually, but you made sure we got on the tennis court and the golf course as part of the training. And
yeah,
one of the things you did is you had me demonstrate. You were going to teach the group, and you had me grab a tennis racket, which I don't really play tennis. And you said, Shane, what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw the ball, and I want you to say bounce when it bounces and hits the ground. And then I don't want you to swing. I just want you to say hit when it was supposed to hit. And so I thought, okay, I'll do that. And we did that for a few minutes or, you know, a couple of times. Bounce, hit, bounce, hit, bounce, hit. And then you said, now, Shane, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to swing at the ball, and I want you to either hit it or miss it. Do you think you can do that? And I remember laughing and going, yes, I can do that. That's great.
That was very positive compared to those who say, I'll try.
Yeah. So what was it about that? What was your technique there? How is that an expression of the inner game? When you say to me, can you hit it or miss it? Do you think you can do that? And here you are a tennis pro, and here I am a total novice, and you're giving me this instruction.
Yeah. Because the learning that the human being has, the capacity to learn, primarily through evolution, developed from learning from experience and not from being told how to swing from tree to tree and when to close your hands and how wide to open them and how far can you jump. All the conceptual instructions of the right way to do it are learned actually without conceptual communication. Now, there are times when concepts make sense, but to be a leader, you don't have to think about leading. And that's what happens when you learn from experience. We'll give more examples of that. But what happened...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering what happened when you were told nothing about how to hit the ball. When you finally swung...
I was relieved.
Yes, you were relieved. There was no right and wrong.
Correct.
So the self-won interference had nothing... didn't know how to interfere. You were just asked to say bounce and hit, and you were confident you could do that. You weren't confident you could hit it, but you thought you probably could. But it took out the doubt, and that was the environment that you want to lead in and to help others be led is... the leader doesn't cause the self-doubt and does what he can to mitigate it.
And you tell a great story of how you came to some of the early insights of the inner game, or at least the motivation to develop it. In your book, The Inner Game of Work, you tell a story about one of your college professors, a very famous psychologist. Tell us that story.
It may have been B.F. Skinner.
That's right. The famous B.F. Skinner, who was known for cognitive behavioral psychology, which is, whether people know it or not, it's one of the dominant ways people believe you should lead and manage others.
Yes.
It's about carrots and sticks. It's about behavior modification, correct?
Yes, except B.F. Skinner said no sticks are needed, just the carrots.
Okay.
So... He suggested that when you see the person doing something, or he did it with pigeons, all his demonstrations were with pigeons, and he asked the class, what do you want me to have the pigeon do? The pigeon was sitting in a gauze kind of cage that was rigged with a light, a bell, and a light bell. Oh, and the food trough coming out. When he pressed the button, those three things would happen. So the student, kind of a smart aleck sophomore, said, I want you to have the pigeon jump in counterclockwise circles on his left foot. Okay. And we had about an hour and a half laboratory to accomplish that. So I don't know how that sounds to you in terms of degree of difficulty.
Sounds hard.
Very hard. So he just watched the pigeon do random pigeon behavior. And the moment he saw the pigeon doing maybe cocked his head to the left or took a step sideways toward the left, he pressed the button, the bell went off, the light came on, and the food trough came out, and the pigeon went and pecked some seeds out of the food trough. So he got his positive reinforcement for some, he didn't know why, but leftward behavior. And Skinner would just wait again till more leftward behavior, and he would reinforce all the leftward behaviors. And the pigeon at the end of a half hour was doing a lot more leftward behaviors than right or clockwise behaviors. But he was never going to finish on time at this rate. But, of course, he had another button. And this button was a very important button. It turned the light on, sounded the bell, and did not put the food trough out. So in his understanding, by that number of times done at exact intervals that he positively reinforced leftward behavior, it was taking a lot of time because the pigeon had to go eat every time he did something right. But this time, food trough didn't come out, but the light and the bell, which are neutral to the pigeon, had become positive to the pigeon because it was associated with getting to eat. So light, which at the beginning was just a light and didn't matter, had been linked to eating, as had the bell. So now he was pressing buttons every second, or much shorter intervals, and that same learning process was happening because it didn't take up time eating. And basically by the end of the class, the damn pigeon was hopping on his left foot in counterclockwise circles and wasn't eating. Maybe at the end he put the food trough out. But his theory was that is what controls human behavior. Now, I was young enough and naive enough to be scared by that.
Mm.
Because it meant I and everybody along with me was controllable by, not by my choice, but by giving me something I liked. And so it happened very fast, and the pigeon would do it, and after a time it would have worn off. But he was saying at the class, he was disappointed seeing there so many more Harvard men than there were Radcliffe women in the class. And he explained, because it'll give them unfair advantage. So basically the motivation for taking the class was you could get the girl to do whatever you wanted her to do by identifying maybe she likes to be scratched on the ear or caressed on the ear. And whenever she does something towards what you wanted to do, you scratched her on the ear, and the frequency of her doing that again would rapidly increase. And that, I said, I was scared. I said, this can't be. But I couldn't figure out why it wasn't that way. And because it doesn't have to happen by a scientist, it just happens in life. Whatever feels good tends to repeat itself.
But now, I want to get into how the inner game relates to leading teams or leadership in general. Before we get to that, there's one little principle that I want you to maybe just articulate a little bit, which is you talk about this triangle, so to speak, of choice, awareness, and trust. Talk us through those elements of the inner game.
Those are the only three principles required in a learning environment to maximize it. You need to be aware of what's in the environment, especially the critical variables of what's in that environment. So when a critical variable in tennis is where does the ball hit on your racket, or if you missed it, I would have said, does it go higher or lower than the racket? And so the student feels his job is to be aware of what happens, not to judge himself of whether it was correct or not correct. So the two big obstacles to learning is self-doubt, and which turns out to trying too hard to impress and look good without understanding, to not raise your hand in class to ask a question you have, get rid of judgment and doubt, and you've gotten at least half of the interferences away. As soon as the student finds he's not getting chastised or, quote, given feedback, then he relaxes and starts learning from how the ball feels on the racket and how it results. So it all happens without just with the coach asking questions about what he or she was aware of. And it looks like magic, because the method of correcting the student by feedback was entirely missing, and the student learned 5 to 10 times faster without those traditional instructions than he did with them. And you see, they're not. Excuse me?
I can speak to that firsthand. When I was at your seminar, you had me golf, and I don't golf at all. And golf is, of course, one of the harder things to learn when you don't know anything about it. And you had a group of people standing behind me watching as you gave me instructions, which were very similar to the tennis instructions. And I believe it was just bring your club back when you think you're all the way to the back, say back. And when you bring your club around, say hit whenever you think you're going to hit the ball. Pay no attention to anything else. And but you said before you do that, Shane, I want you to try to hit the ball as hard and straight as you possibly can. And so I wound up and hauled off on this ball, and I had like a 5-iron, and I think it went maybe 20 yards hard right. And then I went again, hard left, another 30 yards. And then you said, okay, now I don't want you to pay any attention to where the ball is going. I just want you to tell me when it's saying back and when it's saying hit. And then I did that a few times. And then you said, now I want you to hit it the way you would hit it if you were a dancer, however that feels to you, right? These kind of random things. And then you turned to everybody and you said, in those last 5 hits, how long would you say Shane had been playing golf for And the reason you asked that is because every time I did it that way, the ball went straight and 150 yards or 100 yards. And not 100 yards. Yeah, something like that. I don't know. It was long.
150. What iron were you using?
I was a 5-iron. So whatever it was, it was very straight.
Yeah, it was 150 or a little more. Yeah.
Yeah, and you asked people who have been golfing for many years, you said if you didn't know Shane at all, how long would you say Shane has been golfing? And they all said at least a year. And I had, like, just picked up a club for the first time. So that's just a testament to how your method works in athletics.
It's a testament to what happens if you don't get in your own way. And it shows. It points out there's no other reason, because I'm not getting in your way. I'm just throwing the ball and asking you where it is.
It's one of the biggest principles that I experience from your method, which is non-judging awareness. Not just awareness, but non-judging awareness, which I think is one of the hardest things to achieve.
Well, now, awareness is always non-judgmental. Always.
Right.
Awareness is like the sun, and it shines on good people, bad people, dead trees, living trees. It doesn't distinguish who it shines on. And that's like light. Light just lights. Now, when you add to the light what becomes apparent and you see mistakes happening, then the traditional coach, or the way they used to coach, give them feedback. I'm sure that still happens in many businesses. You can say something nice about what they did, and then the next thing you say is the truth. And
so
the last thing
say,
you yes.
Sorry, I'm sorry. So just for, you know, to translate this. So let's say I'm in business and I go, okay, this seems like a powerful thing. How does this apply in things you can't see? So I'm not trying to hit a ball. I'm trying to get a guy who's really argumentative or micromanaging to stop micromanaging because it's costing my business money and time. And I need to tell him to stop acting this way. I need to change his behavior so that we can get on with the business. How do I do that with this method?
Well, it would be nice if you could recognize how your helpfulness was really... even though true, you told him what he shouldn't be doing and you told him something what he should be doing, that will create tension, make you the judge, and make him self-conscious and make him doubt. So you want not to be a good coach. You want, and this is how the inner game began, you want the student to learn. And the best teacher is their experience. I'm going to give you an example from business. And it's such a simple example, you won't believe it. But the CEO of the company said that one of his direct reports was really overly aggressive and overly micromanaging. They sometimes go together. And he said, I think I would like to ask you to give him some coaching. And he was a CEO. I had just been brought on to help. I didn't have much choice, but I said, okay, I'll take this on as long as you don't have expectations of how I coach. And I will promise that you will see him acting less aggressive and less micromanaging. And he said, I don't care how you do it. He's a pain in the neck now, and he's very critical of me. So I'll know. And I said, okay. So now, what am I going to do? If I go to the direct report and say the CEO has asked us to spend a little time where I would coach you. And this is one of the tools of the inner game. Before doing that, put yourself in the place of that manager when I come up and say, I've been asked to coach you. What's he feeling? What's he thinking? He's thinking, I guess, what am I doing wrong? Because that's what people think coaching is, to correct what's wrong. And he goes through it and thinks of excuses in his head. And so he's all prepared for whatever behavior you bring up to defend it. And because he doesn't want to be wrong, he doesn't want to think he needs coaching. That's a big one. I'm a lower guy if I'm the one that needs the coaching. But the way inner game coaches, you don't give him expertise. That you just get him to pay attention to what is happening or what he's doing. And I know that sounds so simple, but I couldn't call it coaching because then he'd think I was trying to improve him. So I just said,
right.
You know, there's some of your colleagues that are doing some research, and they're doing research on the direct reports of the various leaders. And the research is to pay attention to their eye movements. Where are their eyes looking when you're presenting your feedback or your vision or whatever it is that you're communicating? And that's about, I mean, you mean I just watch their eyes? And what do? Just watch their eyes and come back and tell me afterwards what happened. So it didn't make much sense to him, but it was research. How much of the direct reports paying attention to the leaders? And he came back after a week. I said, what'd you find out? And he said, in the first 2.5 days, the eyes were just going all over the place. Sometimes they're looking at their shoes. Sometimes they're looking out the window. Sometimes they're looking at the ceiling. And it hardly ever goes to the speaker. And I said, and then? He said, and then? In middle of the third day and all the way through the fourth and fifth, the eyes were steadily focused on the eyes of the speaker. And he said, I don't get it. He said, well, did you do anything differently in that day 3, 4, and 5 than you did in the first two? And no, I was just being myself. And he knew that he'd done something differently, but he didn't want to admit it, and I didn't care. And I said, well, whether you knew what you did or not, you got their attention. And I said, next week, I want you to pay attention to your own voice as you speak to them. That's a variable that changes the environment. And sometimes a leader needs to be very strong, very clear. This is to underline its importance and its precision, and this is a must. Sometimes a leader is just giving information, telling what the situation is like, and helping them become more aware. And so he's just asking them questions. But he does that, gives information in a very neutral way, not strong. I didn't put any negative on aggression. It's just there's a time and a place. And so he said, well, yeah, I understand that difference. And then finally, sometimes the leader wants to use a voice that brings out receptiveness from the group. So he's inviting, he's kind of, instead of just giving a lecture, he's inviting interest and inviting thinking. And he does that in a very enticing way or interesting way. And
so, it's amazing. It's truly amazing how this changes things without sort of doing
the rest
of the approach. I promise,
just 10 more seconds and I can finish the story.
Of course.
I come back the next week and ask him, what percentage of the time did you find your voice was strong and forceful? What percentage was neutral? What percentage was inviting? And the strong was about 10%. The neutral was about 40%. And then he said, and the inviting was the rest. My math isn't very good. It was the rest. And I said, did you try to manipulate your voice? He said, no. I just knew those three categories, what I was trying to do called for different tones of voice. So I said, well, how do you explain that? Oh, what he said, the results were at the end, not only were they looking at my eyes, but they were giving their honest opinions about, they were saying when they weren't clear, they were asking questions. They were engaged in the learning process. That's what they wanted to learn. They didn't want to look good. They just wanted to learn. But they didn't know what they were supposed to be learning. So what they learned was rapport with the leader, and that the leader was being in rapport with them. And that creates trust, and that creates interest, and that creates learning, because I want to find out rather than I want to do it right. I want to do what I'm told. So I said, certainly you must have, I said that 10%, 40, and 50%, is that what you normally get from your, is that the way you usually address? He said, yeah, I wasn't doing anything differently. I was just being myself. And I said, that's amazing. They just changed because you were changing your tone of voice. And he had this big smile on his face that revealed he knew he was doing it differently. He wasn't speaking like he usually did. He was speaking appropriate to the situation and the results that he was wanting. And so the smile said, I know I wasn't the same, but I didn't get him to tell me. He didn't have to confess anything. He didn't have to think right and wrong. You just needed to be in tune with the direct reports.
That's so powerful. So
the short story.
Yeah. Well, and you have so many other stories. We won't have time to get through all of them. The book that I highly recommend for anybody who's interested in this in a work setting is the book called The Inner Game of Work. And then, of course, the seminal book that even, you know, Tom Brady has been seen quoting, Steve Kerr, the head coach of the Warriors. These guys have also identified The Inner Game of Tennis as one of the best books they've read on sports psychology. So if you're an athlete, in addition to being a leader, then that's a book I definitely recommend. Tim,
let me just correct one sentence, if I may.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't say they didn't praise the leader. They just said the whole conversation was more interesting and more fun. And I learned so much more.
It's you mean in the story you told about the leader who was modifying his bowling? Got it.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, they enjoyed it more. Well, the other thing that I know you've talked about, there are two other things that I think are excellent that people should dig into when they get a chance, is you talk about selling as facilitating decision-making. Which maybe just say, you know, 2 minutes on that.
Well, let's say how sales departments define selling and define the desired results of selling. It's very easy. Sell as much as you can for as much as you can. And it's about selling. They're taught in their training what to say, what to ask, how to sell. And I asked the group, how come the conversation between a salesperson and a buyer, a potential buyer, is called selling? Is selling the important thing that's happening, or is buying the important thing that's happening? And, you know, of course they sell selling at first. That's all we talk about is how to sell. But no, the important thing is buying. If you give a brilliant sales pitch, the buyer can still say, no, I don't want it. I want the competition's product. So the person who's selling is disappointed, feels he's failed, and when he goes back to his meeting, that's what he's going to be asked. How many sales did you make? What was the total revenues you brought in? And what was the total number of calls you made? And obviously the revenues were the measure of how good he was at sales. And I said, what would happen if you thought that the sales conversation was about the buyer trying to make a decision? Do I need it? Do I not need it? Is this what I want? compared to the competition, or if the competition's better. And then, so he's recognized as being in charge. And the seller's job is to ask questions and give information that will help the buyer make his best decision. So, what is the greatest obstacle that buyers make when they're getting a sales pitch? They shut down. They don't want to be sold. They want to make the right decision. And they know the salesperson already knows the right decision. Buy my product. And I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, but it changes the whole relationship between the salesperson and the buyer, so that the buyer doesn't have the resistance to being sold that he normally has. And he doesn't have the doubt in the salesperson. Because if he says, yes, this is, salesperson says, this is the product for you. I've listened to you. I've listened to the needs. I've listened to your goals. This is clearly the best thing because of this and this and this and this. And the buyer's supposed to say, yeah, I guess you're right. And buys it. He wishes he hadn't a week later. So in this kind of selling, it wouldn't be, well, I'll just cut it short. There are times when the salesperson recommends a product of the competition for what he needs. Uh-huh. Now, what do you think that does to the buyer's trust in the salesperson?
It goes way up.
It goes way up. He's going to get a lot better listening. He's going to put a lot more trust in the information because he knows it's not all geared. It's geared to him. Not to the salesperson's goals,
yeah,
which make
right.
the sale. And so he makes many more sales because the relationship between the two is in the right place. So,
well, the reason I wanted to talk about the sales piece is, you know, leadership seminar or, you know, teleseminars. In leadership, you are also, in effect, selling. But another way to frame that using the inner game is, as a leader, you are facilitating other people's decisions. And it's just another way to think about your role as a leader, it seems to me.
Well, that would be nice. But how many leaders make the decision for the subordinate? So the subordinate doesn't really think what's the best way. He just said, how does a leader want it? I'll do it that way. And I hope I'm not caught when I'm not doing it.
That's
it's
exactly
just
right.
A less mature relationship.
That's
and
exactly right.
It actually, the sales school, I went out in the field and I asked the salesman, how was your sales school? They said, it was the best. It was the cutting edge in selling. And I just praised it. And I said, so it sounds like it was 100% successful. And the salesman said, yeah, there was just one thing wrong. I said, well, what was that? And he said, mine went blank. He said, that's really strange. Tell me where we were.
So you were saying it was a great sales conference, and you said, what was great about it?
Yes, the guy found out from asking the salesman that the competition had two whistles and a bell that his product didn't have, but that would be very useful to him. And so he bought the competition. And normally that would be a big disappointment to the salesperson. But he went back to the sales force and said, I finally found out why some people weren't buying our product. It's missing a couple of bells and a whistle. And if you're not interested in that, I'm going to product development and ask them about why they don't have it, and I'll take what I learned and make it available to the people who are designing the product. And so he felt when the no came, he was inquiring. He really wanted to know why he wanted the competition's product, and he used that learning to improve their product, which in the final analysis improved total revenues by, you know, upwards to $1 million that year, because they made a better product that overcame those obstacles and of the buyer, and the trust was there. So the what was a negative, I didn't make that sale, became the most positive thing any salesman had done. They made an improvement to their darn product. And that's what
amazing.
Keeps
so,
salespeople from being aggressive.
Yeah. Well, it's powerful stuff. Tim, it has been a pleasure having you on this conversation. Anybody who would like to learn more, as I understand it, the best place to go is theinnergame.com. Is that correct?
There's a book that was written by an Inner Game student. I wrote the foreword to it, but he just learned the Inner Game. He'd been a sales director of sales for
I just mean if people want to get in touch with you and what you're doing, theinnergame.com is the best place to go.
Innergame.com, or if you want to write, Tim Galway, at gmail.com.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your time and your wisdom, Tim. We really appreciate it. Good to be with you.
Are we totally out of time, or do you have 2 minutes? Because the main point I want to make, I haven't had a chance.
Yes, go ahead.
The most revolutionary question I could ask to a leader who was looking to improve their leadership is, who's leading the leader? You'll hear self-won voices telling you how to do it right and what their leader thought, or you'll have self-two answering the question, coming up with creative, innovative ideas. They're thinking. The danger of micromanagement is the people who are subject to micromanagement abdicate their responsibility. And it's whatever the leader says. So they're just servants. But they're also the people who actually are with the people in the field, or they know, it's their experience. And we all have trouble realizing that we're the CEO of this one human life. And when the not only the leaders can accept that, but they realize that everyone they're speaking to has that same position. They're the CEO of one human life. And that's ultimately, even while they're working, and while they're working, they can be evolving, and they can discover by all the challenges what potential is needed from them to develop. And they're the active agent. They're the beneficiary of the challenge. So they seek the challenge, and they think, rather than, leader's there, whatever he wants, I'll do, because that's how I keep my job. Yeah. That's an inferior way of thinking than thinking of, I ask leaders, where did you learn the most about, well, it's usually management, at business school, or in your first few months on the job, or your first year at the job, on the job. They all say, you know, on the job I learned most. But where is that reflected in the development plan of managers to be leaders? You don't want them to stop thinking and just become blindly obedient. And you don't want them to argue and compete for leadership, but you want them to be clear. You want them to, even if there's something you said that they see isn't going to work, I would hope your leaders would want them to say it. Not that the leader's always right and he'll lose the confidence of his followers if he ever says, I changed my mind because of this or that. So it's, that's it. Everyone is a CEO, and that is not the culture that most, that any corporations I know really embraced, because they believe in the chain of, what's it called? Chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
So leaders need to think. Yes, go ahead.
It's a great note to end on, that we should all think of ourselves as CEOs regardless of the position we're in, and to try to evoke that mentality in everyone we lead, that they are also CEOs. Tim, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Hope I-